podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Really got a try on that left-hand side. What happened?
Oh, but I've gone up and over and he head over biscuit. It wasn't enough stability there for myself, but no, I was busting for a bit of meat this game. It didn't seem to work out.
Hello, cheers, and welcome to the Scrum of the Earth podcast, the weekly show for news, reviews, great interviews, and so much more, all about the world of rugby. My name is David Lawrence. I'm an American rugby fan who follows the game wherever I can find it, all over the globe. If you'd like to get in touch, well, I'm easy to find on all your socials. You can always just drop an email to thescrumoftheearth@gmail.com. Well, you have undoubtedly deduced that this is not your regular weekly episode, but is in fact yet another bonus episode. This time, I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome a very special new guest, a leading voice in New Zealand rugby. She's a freelance journalist, content creator, presenter, advocate, and MC. And you can find her weekly column in the New Zealand Herald on Sundays, as well as features for The Locker Room, The Spinoff, The Guardian, and the Sunday Star Times. I'm speaking, of course, of the one, the only Alice Soper. Ms. Soper, welcome to the Scrum of the Earth, and how the heck are you?
I'm good. I'm also glad that we didn't have the conversation about my last name, and that's usually where people trip up. So good on you, David. You nailed it in one.
Thank God. So we already did talk about this, but am I okay to call you Alice for the purposes of our show here today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can call me Al if you want. Like the
I know that song.
It's a banger.
On your own website, one of the first things the visitors will see is where it says, "Who the F is Alice Soper?" And the first part of the answer simply reads, "Great question." I could read the rest of the answer, but I mean, you're here right now. Why don't you tell us the rest of that answer?
Yeah, sure. So, kia ora koutou. I will make sure to introduce myself, but I will translate as well for people that might not have the language. So, he uri o no Ngāti Kōtirangi, Ngāti Airihi, Kōnua hoki, which means that my colonial whānau are from family, are from Scotland, Ireland, and Cornwall. E tipu aku oku mātoa e Gore. My parents are from Gore, which is a place in the south of New Zealand, south of the South Island. Engari ko au he putiputi e puawai, e roto e te whanganui a tara. But this beautiful blossom flowered in Wellington, that's where I live now. Ko Alice Soper, tōku ingoa, tēnā koutou, tēnā rā tātou katoa. So my name is Alice Soper. Hello to everyone. So making sure to do that because we won't go too into politics, or maybe we will, but there is a bit of a pushback against Te Reo Māori, which is the native language of New Zealand, of Aotearoa, at the moment. So it's even more important for folks like myself to make sure that we kōrero, that we speak Te Reo Māori where we can as our own little pushback and resistance. Because, if you want to know anything about me, it's that.
Pushback.
Pushback and resistance, yeah?
Yes.
Look, I've played rugby since I was a little kid. There wasn't organised stuff for me when I was a little girl, so I played it at school, like lots of Kiwi kids. But we had concrete at my school, so we'd play touch when the teachers were watching, and then it would be tackle when they went away. It wasn't until I got to high school when I was 13 that I got to play organised rugby for the first time. I was really lucky that my sports coordinator was a local legend, played for the Wellington team for a number of years, Marama Tauroa. And so she brought me in, and she then also brought me over to Clubland, because at that time they didn't have rules against schoolgirls playing women's rugby. So I was 13 and playing in the women's grade. Have played most of my rugby here out of Wellington, spent a couple of years playing over in the English Premiership. They won't get to see pictures, but that is my Richmond jersey that's over my shoulder here. So I played in the
Crabbies logo.
Yeah, I know, right? Should get a commission on that placement. But so I played there in the 2017 through to 2019, came back here to Aotearoa, New Zealand, and then probably kicked off this latest version of me, which is being outspoken on behalf of this. I'd always done this. I was always the lovable loudmouth in my team. I always joke that I was probably picked more for my comms than anything else, any other type of skill set. So makes sense, of course, to keep using that now that I'm off the field. So yeah, working primarily as I work entirely for myself now and just talk and think and dream about all things, particularly women's rugby, but whatever else comes my way that seems interesting.
So you did a fantastic opinion piece for The Guardian almost exactly 2 years ago as we're speaking right now, where you said, quote, "As has been the case with women's rugby for a while now, it's been easier to stage something than to change something. We can put on flashier kits, play on the main field, have live match coverage, and feel like progress is being made. However, virtually everyone involved is still only able to give half of themselves," unquote. I mean, that was 2 years ago. Since then, we've had the most successful Women's World Cup of all time. The WXV has launched. Six Nations tournament is happening right now and is smashing attendance records. For you, how much has changed since you wrote that?
It's been a pretty lopsided growth, I would say. I
Okay.
think that, you've seen the best success story. It's not surprising, right? Because they had the best infrastructure coming in. Of course, was England coming out of that World Cup. They had understood, I was just talking about this with someone the other day. I was like, I don't think we ever really bid to host the World Cup here in New Zealand as part of a growth strategy. I fundamentally think that New Zealand rugby didn't understand the gift that they were about to be given, or that there would be the,
Really?
explosion of interest. Honestly, no, because you look at how they resourced it. It was all kind of accidental. The story
Wow.
now is one of success, but I think that that success was brought by the public rather than by a whole heap of intention. I think that,
Wow.
a lot of the time when it comes to this stuff, the secret sauce in all of this is timing, and I just think the timing was right. That there had been a number of factors here in our country that had lined up to make a women's sports event take off. The Cricket World Cup had just been held at the beginning of the year. They had been hamstrung by the fact that COVID was still restricting audiences, but there had been a real investment and focus from our government over the last few years around targeting women and girls sports. And so all of these pieces had come together in such a way that, yeah, it was waiting for kind of that match to be lit. And that was the performance of the team. And so unfortunately, I feel like the momentum of that moment has been dropped. And you see that in the fact that, we had a sellout stadium here for that final. And the most fascinating stat that came out of that for me was that 70% of those that attended that final had never watched rugby before. And that's
Wow,
here in
I
a
didn't know that.
country that claims our game to be our national sport. And yet
Right.
still 70% of those people came because they came to something different. They came to something new,
Because
but
they
we
were
didn't hold
visitors
their
or because they
hands.
were New Zealanders who were new to it?
New Zealanders that were new, because the thing
Wow.
is like there's been this kind of rumbling disconnect, and this is like there is a oh there's such a terrible trend that's also happening globally right now within rugby, right? Which is like w the women's stuff is finally starting to come of age and starting to get some momentum, just as like the financial institutions are completely crumbling in the men's game. New Zealand rugby is in dire straits. There's a live tussle that's going on between our current board of directors, our players association, and our provincial unions that are like the member unions. Like this is all kicking off when I'm like, can someone just please try and market this thing, let alone, pay people properly, let alone have a pathway, all of this type of stuff. So yeah, I feel like there is a general understanding that is there now of the challenges. I feel like I have to spend less of my time talking about that now, but I feel like we're still stuck in problem identification rather than moving into any real solutions, and that's a real frustration for me.
Well, you almost perfectly teed that up for me, and I think this is the last time I'm going to quote you at you. But I mean, you're such a great writer, I can't resist. There was a great piece, I think it was an interview for the New York Times, and you said, quote, "You talk to most women's rugby players, and they understand that their job is not just to play the game, but to promote the game, to coach the game, to be a full-time hype person for the game. It would be really easy if all you had to do was enjoy rugby to play rugby, unquote. I mean, can you expand on that a little bit? Like, is that something you see changing in the foreseeable future, or just women just doomed to work twice as hard as men to get half the credit?
I mean, I feel like it's just, it's this whole infrastructure around the sport, right? Like, so if I put this in an American example, you've just had this huge moment, right, around your college basketball. And this has all been like, a lot of the conversation and focus, right, has been about this key marquee player, which has been Caitlin Clark, right? But she is standing in top, on top of an infrastructure that has developed over time, that has reached a height so that now a star like that can step up and become visible. If you look at the rugby example of that, that was 1995 to 1996 when the men's game became professional, and suddenly there was all this infrastructure in, like, in terms of the marketing, the promotion, the professionalism of the sport, the broadcast deals, and what they needed then was the star to sell it, and at that moment was Jonah Lomu, right? So we're seeing this within college basketball right now, within the women's game over in the US, where, like, Caitlin is the tip of the iceberg of all of that infrastructure that has been built underneath to support. There have been Caitlin Clarks before. For goodness sake, you know that because one of the coaches was, what, Dawn Staley, who, from what I understand, was a Caitlin Clark of her day. Like, she are so many examples, right? But it's that whole infrastructure around that is still so underdeveloped across the women's rugby world. I think the best, you know, piece that we have seen, like, conscientiously developed is over in England, their domestic competition being the strongest, that has then given you a wider infrastructure in terms of those coaches, but also in terms of writers, in terms of promotions, in terms of social media content, in terms of all of that stuff that sits around. Whereas if you look at, say, for example, in our country, we're still, like, you know, 1% professional, 99% un, you know, like, most of us are still volunteers within the sport in terms of keeping these things ticking over. And, like, even down to, so Black Ferns are now finally at a pay, at being paid at a rate which is livable, like a livable wage. We wouldn't say anyone's getting wealthy off that. Women in the NRLW, the rugby league competition, are getting paid more than current Black Ferns captains. So let's check that reality. But then the other part of that is that, like, just outside of that, Opiki, women are still half part-time and are going, you know, are in camp Thursday through Sunday and then back to work Monday through Wednesday. And it's hard to, you know, have these conversations because a lot of time you go, oh, but that's so much better than other parts of the world. But shouldn't it be? If we're supposed to be the nation of that loves rugby the most, shouldn't we be the best example to help rise other nations to say that we can do more? So I just, I think it's that whole infrastructure around it that is just so rickety. And in terms of that staging and changing thing, right? Like, I liken it a lot to, like, a cardboard cutout, right? You push, put any type of pressure on it, it just falls over. That's kind of where we're sitting here at the moment.
Well, the dilemma of professionalism for the women has clearly been, oh, okay, finally, you know, we found this money and here you go. You can have $25,000 a year or whatever it is. And it's like, well, thanks, but I've been a doctor for 8 years and, you know, that doesn't cut it. That's not good enough. It's a weird stage where professionalism is happening and there's these offerings, but it's not good enough. Like, this must be something you struggle with all the time.
Yeah, and also, like, okay, if we're not going to pay people properly, why are we doing it at all? That's kind of my question. It's like, if we're at that moment where we can't afford to make people professional, I don't know why we're giving them any money. I would then rather that money be put into making those programs professional, and then we give people the wages. Because the reality is like, New Zealand rugby has painted themselves into a corner, for example, when it comes to Super Rugby Opiki, because they are having such a limited budget in terms of its operation. They cannot extend the competition, which is the primary thing they need to do in terms of lifting the standards of, like, the overall talent pool here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, in terms of creating a thing that's going to try and hold on to talent that is being approached from all different angles in terms of different sports. they won't give them more game time because it comes with too high of a price tag because you're paying for each of those players. You compare that, say, to the way that England had rolled out that premiership. You know, I didn't get paid when I played in those 2 years over there, but I got to play for 4 months of a year. And what that did for me as a player was worth that input, right? Like that, okay. It was worth it for me to then know, hey, like, we're actually building something here that is going to develop me as a player, rather than I'm only half doing it because I'm, you know, trying to fit it in around being here. Now I've got to go back home on Tuesday. Like, you're living a half life. And that means that, but as soon as you're giving anybody any money, it comes with a full set of expectations.
It's like, hey, we gave you the contract, you know?
Yeah.
Your life is ours now.
Yeah. And like, I always laugh too, because I'm like, all of the administrators that sit there and tell you it's a great start and that, you know, isn't it wonderful that we're doing this and now there's one more week this year. I always think, do you want to take those wages? Because you're sitting in that office on at least double that. So do you want to? Oh, you don't, because you can't live on it? And yet these women, if you're athletes, that is such a controlled lifestyle in terms of what you eat, where right. you go, how you sleep, how you do all of this. But you, as an office admin person who's just sending emails, is paid more than that? Like, what is going on here? Like, this, none of this, the maths ain't mathing, as I would say.
That's officially the title of this episode. I warned you ahead of time that my questions were going to be all over the place. And clearly, this is a great example. So here in the United States, our women's Eagles have historically been ranked higher and have performed better than our men's program. Is that phenomenon unique to the United States? Can you think of other examples of countries where, you know, Canada, they've had a similar history? Canada, of course.
Canada being the most, Australia in the last few years, because let's be real, their men's team have not been flash for a while. So, like, I would say last year, perfect example. The Wallabies are completely imploding while the Wallaroos have maybe one of their best seasons in recent memory. You know, they finished higher than the Black Ferns in the WXV. So, I would say USA, Canada being the prime example. Also France, who are regularly number two or three. I mean, their men's team, who are also obviously a high performing side, but like, are they often within that conversation? You know, if we're talking rankings, it's also just like entirely different. And I think, again, this is why a competition such as like WXV brings me such heart. Like, I'm less worried about tier one of it, but tier two and three is where the magic is, right? Because right now, because we are such at our infancy in terms of professionalizing, you know, you look even before the kickoff of last World Cup to after, how many programs have become professional in like this 2 year period. That gap that exists within the men's game between what they call, they say tier one, tier two, I don't like that, developing and established rugby nations. That's more what it is, right? So when you look at the gap that exists between developing and established in the men's game, that's a massive gap that you're trying to get people to leap, whereas that gap is nowhere near as entrenched within the women's game. And so that's why the moves of like WXV are so smart right now, because you have the opportunity to make rugby a truly global game in the way that it is not in the men's rugby right now. It is the old colonial powers and the USA, and that's about it. Like, we're not really breaking into other parts of the world.
Are you happy with the WXV? Do you like the sort of first iteration we've got of it? Do you think it? Okay, my take was, that was great. I want to see what's next. I feel like it's going to get better. Where do you land on that?
Yeah, look, I think it's a really tricky one, right? Because I think in terms of like, I've got to be honest, in terms of someone who's like trying to communicate and get people into the game of rugby, boy howdy, is that a really difficult sell. Like, it is not a straightforward qualification process. It is not a straightforward, like,
winner-loser
scenario. That stuff is all pretty convoluted and difficult. But the main thing for me is, when I look at the overall, what is the purpose of that tournament, right? The goals and the opportunities that tournament is unlocking is exactly what I want. So I will take it being a little bit messy if it means that I get to see how things are changing for Samoa, for Fiji, for Tonga, for
For South Africa.
Brazil, South Africa, all of these different countries who are like, I mean, I say Samoa a lot of the time because here where I live in Wellington, I think it was something like 79% of our player base have Samoan heritage. So,
Wow.
like, a lot of the girls I'm talking to now that I'm coaching and that are around us, our conversation is not just about a black jersey, it's also about a blue one because they could play for Samoa and they are now given another way. Like, I saw it when I played over in England. A lot of the women that I played with, they might not just be England reps, right? They were Welsh, they were Irish, they were French, they were whatever, but they had all of these options in terms of regular international games that they could play through the Six Nations. We haven't had that here. We eventually got PAC 4 set up. That took 1,000 fucking years. Sorry for swearing, but that took
That's
a thousand years,
okay.
right? And then there's been nothing really for like the Pacific teams. I think it was something like it took, goodness, I can't remember the stat, over 10 years though, right? For Samoa to get to play like 10 tests. Like it's crazy. Whereas with the introduction of WXV, they're going to double the amount of total tests they've played within 6 years. And so that to me is like, yeah, it's ugly, but I love it. I love it much more than, say, the British and Irish Lions tour, which I think makes no sense in
Yeah,
a
that's a
women's
weird
rugby
one.
context.
I didn't leave any room in my script for that. I think I'm glad I chose not to.
I mean, I sit on the like less. I think that this is. I saw Megan Rapinoe giving an interview the other day where she was saying that like, men, a women's sport is saving men's sport right now, and I feel like this is a great example of that in the in rugby, right? Like, the British and Irish Lions brand is so irrelevant now. Like it's a tradition that like feels old and that is actually counter to what people want. Like they want to see the developing nations get more opportunities to take big scalps, right? They love it when Japan beats South Africa. They love it when Samoa has a go. Like, so they don't want to see the old boys rolling around playing their same old mates over and over again, right? And so what are we doing? We're copying it. And not only that, World Rugby's making a concession and putting this beautiful development tournament on hold to make countries that already get to play a heap of bloody tests, more tests. That is entrenching the divide. And I'm like, why? We know where this leads. We've seen 30 years of this. We've seen the mess it leads to. Why the heck are we copying and pasting that nonsense over here? So, yeah, sorry, that's my.
No, you're spot on, and for whatever it's worth, the last actual like the men's Lions tour, the last one, it ruined everyone involved. I don't think any player has been the same since that. Everyone involved is like, oh my God, nobody's been the same since then.
I mean, it was like I don't get me wrong. I love the touring aspect, like in terms
Sure.
of like midweek games and stuff. I'd love to see us doing
I
more of
like that.
that stuff, right? Like when Ireland was here not that long ago, and they're playing the Maori All Blacks and they're playing the Hurricanes for us. I would love to see versions of that happen. I would love, like, to me, when I saw the case study come out from the business case, which, like, what a waste of time and money that was. Just give that straight to the games development, please, rather than going, money, women's sport. Do you think it could make money? Like, hello, I think we've established that already. But okay. Yeah. Oh, do people like women? Like, yes,
All
they
the
do.
girls playing nowadays.
So, like, rather than, when that came out, all that actually said to me is, oh, awesome. We've now got the business case for touring. So let's bring England here in May and get them to play Super Rugby Opiki time teams midweek. Like, mint, let's do that. Like, let's bring back like the beautiful scenes that were like the Samoan tour here in New Zealand in the 90s when they were on the bus and like drove all over the country and everybody came out and it was like magic because it was you could touch it. And instead, what are we doing? We're putting more barriers around stuff and making it more like us and them and more hierarchical, and nobody wants that.
Well, we, to change gears here, we just finished the third season of Super Rugby Opiki. What's your take on this competition, and you know, where does it go from here? Like, the obvious question is, does it expand? We you know, the Manawa are kind of a hodgepodge of two teams, is that right? Or you know, connected with two teams at least for the men. Is it obvious that those will become two separate teams? Like, what's going on with these teams, and what's going to happen in the future?
Sorry, are you meaning probably Matatu rather than Manawa? Because the Chiefs, yes. Manawa are catch the Chiefs, whereas Matatu,
yes,
are the entire South Island franchise. Yes, who like exactly. Are currently covering Highlanders and Crusaders area.
That is absolutely what I meant, and I'm going to edit this out later. Except that I'm probably not going to do that.
There's two ways to answer that, right? Which is like, okay, how do you make Opiki as it exists right now be the most functional for what it is we need it to do? And then the other question is, if we didn't do Opiki, what would we do? And I think both are worth interrogating, because again, like, the major thing that's shaking up the New Zealand rugby scene currently is basically the damning report that came out not too long ago that said that New Zealand was unable to sustain two domestic competitions here in New Zealand for men. So we can't do provincial rugby and super rugby, right? Provincial rugby being like our kind of like states, I guess, where we're like playing our club teams, we get picked for our province. And that currently there are 13 like top provinces. There's a few heartland underneath that, but 13 provinces that cover the country. Women also play provincial rugby. That's what's called the Farah Palmer Cup.
Yeah, this past year was the first year I could watch the NPC and the FPC, and it was fantastic. Oh, cool. But I've heard weird things about both these competitions being in trouble.
Yeah, so like this is the tension between basically the transition that we made to professionalism, right? Which like all of the root of these issues goes back to like 1996 and probably earlier than that, in the early 90s, around how it is that rugby made its money, where like a really big pivot happened at that point, where it went away from kind of like gate sales and like fan engagement, like merchant and stuff, more to primarily coming in through broadcast revenue. That was like in the early 90s. So since then, our like in attendance has basically trended downwards because the game has been so optimized in terms of watching at home. And the other reality is it's a winter sport. It's cold. They put it on at 7 p.m. so that people around the world can watch it in terms of their international broadcast. But that's rubbish. If you are living here in New Zealand and you don't want to go sit out in the cold at 7 p.m. and pay too much money for a stale chips and a sad beer, like, no, you watch it at home, you know, so, or at the pub with your mates. Anyway, so that's like that question to me around, do I actually, were I designing this from scratch, this is not be how I would do it. I would get rid of Opiki, because I don't think it's necessary. I think the better example, I think it was an example that was created by looking at what existed in men's rugby and copying and pasting. I think it was a political decision that was made by New Zealand Rugby because they had a more manageable relationship with franchises as opposed to provincial unions. And so it was easier to kind of work that commercial conversation through franchises, which are privately owned, over provincial unions, which are like members based. So that piece, I would have instead looked over at the Premier Rugby in England, seen that probably the most close equivalent that we had was the Farah Palmer Cup, and I would have invested in that competition. Oh. That competition currently runs 6 to 8 weeks, depending on whether you get playoffs, right?
I love that competition. Last year was so much fun.
Yeah. So I would, if I had been designing this, I would have bumped that up. I would have put a lot more resource in terms of making those environments minimum operating standards, similar to what we saw when they brought out Premiership Rugby, right, in England. Because I can tell you, I played all of my provincial rugby out of Wellington. My experience was vastly different than, say, what the setup is in Canterbury Rugby, what it is in Auckland Rugby, what it is even in Manawatu. So, like, get a universal baseline of operating standards through that, that then produces a baseline results in terms of things. That's what I would have done. We haven't done that. Instead, we've brought in OPICI. It sits at the wrong time in terms of our calendar. That's the first thing. It plays March to a little bit of April. That's when our club season starts here in Aotearoa. So firstly, you've got no fans because we're all plugged into our communities. You know, like I had to do a mad dash after one of my games to drive up to watch one of our home games and like missed kickoff, you know, like because you just
Wow.
couldn't make it work. So it's in the wrong time
Are
because
they
we're
doing a
not
lot of fun? Are
filming it
they doing double
properly.
headers? Like, don't the Blues women play,
Oh, yeah, I hate double headers. That's another whole, don't get me started on that just yet. But so I would have taken, if I was planning it in terms of what makes sense in terms of our domestic scene, I would put Opiki right after FPC, because then you've got people that have, you're bringing two things together. One, you're bringing the viewers' experience together. They've just got into the sport. They've w watched the whole way through FPC. They've got to know the characters, as it were. They've got invested in the storylines. They can now watch those stars carry over into their franchises. So you've built that bridge for them in terms of an on-ramp, but also in terms of we're not paying these players properly in terms of their preparation, in terms of getting ready. We have a really short preseason. So why not use FPC as that preseason? By the time we get to the end of the FPC, players are hitting their strides. I mean, Martha Mateili made her Blackfern debut off the back of her Canterbury season in the FPC. So use that and then put Opiki at the end there to play in. And we can juggle a little bit where FPC sits. We've done that in the past during World Cup years. Traditionally, it's always played late August through to kind of early October. You could bring that forward. There's nothing that stops you from playing that July, August, you know. And then you've got Opiki after that, September, October, then you're hitting the international window again. I just don't think that type of stuff is very well thought through. If you did that, I'd be happier. You also need to have a crossover yesterday. Like it should have, that crossover should have been teed up for the moment that the World Cup finished. The sitting on hands was where rugby died, you know? Like you killed any chance at really changing the game here by not shifting things up. It took over 140 days for New Zealand rugby to announce when the next Black Ferns home test was after that Rugby World Cup. Like that's insane, you know? That's
They
not how you run a business.
seemed determined to drop the ball over and over.
Yeah, there's knock-ons everywhere. Like reset, scrum reset after scrum reset. It was just,
So as
yeah.
someone relatively new to these competitions, though, like the Opiki this year was great. I really loved it. And the final, I mean, how good. 18-5 down with 20 minutes to go. The Blues, they pulled it out. I mean, your reactions in the moment, that was an instant classic, right?
I mean, I made a lot of people a lot of money on that game because somehow the odds had picked Mount Manawa, but you knew it was Blues just the way that they'd tracked during the season. And that I would say instant classic, but also it's becoming apparent that this is part of the patterns of Opiki, the fun patterns that are emerging. First one being if you come last one season, you win the next. So
I was going to
Matatu
mention that.
lost,
It's in my little list for sure.
Matatu lost season one, won season two. Chiefs, so and then the Blues lost season two, won season three. So that's good for me because I'm a Hurricanes POA. So we lost this year. So surely next year's are you?
Yeah, I
But
was going to
the
say, like, the transitive property tells us the Hurricanes Pua
come on,
have
it
to
has to
win
be.
next year.
I mean, also in terms of why I was picking the Blues, it's retention rates. So the players at the club and the franchises that have had the highest retention rates have then led to championships. So that was the big secret between Matatu season one and two. And that was the big thing that changed for the Blues between season two and three. They bled so many players in their first season. It wasn't a good experience. Their setup wasn't right. Season two to three, they held on to like a good 70% of their roster. And then that's what carries them to. So like with that type of stuff. But then I would say the other pattern that emerges is last year was like that too. Manawa had a penalty they just needed to kick and they would have won. and they missed it. And they and Matatu won by a hair. And that was after they just missed a conversion earlier too that would have won it. So like, if it tells you anything, OPEC games are going to be super tight and they're going to be like that. But I think it also tells you that whatever perceived like differences there are between these squads, they narrow over the competition. We always see it's bite right by the end, you know, because just like you see in any competition, the first two, three games, it takes time to get your timing. So as soon as they have that time together, then they start hitting those angles, then they start getting that set piece functional. Yep. And then by week three, there's always a pivot and things start heating up. So it's like, that's where it's just like, please make this competition longer. And please don't piss on my back and tell me it's raining. Because the number of people that are saying, oh, wasn't it amazing this year? It was a longer competition. I said, by 1 week, and I didn't get a semifinal. So, like, I mean, give me, I want at least 10 weeks before it's a competition.
That begs the question of expansion, though, right? Because if it's just four teams, you can't really make it that much longer, right? Like, what are you going to play two home and two away to every single team? Like, it becomes awkward if you do that, right? So, if
I don't
you want
care.
Season...
Give me that. You know what I mean? Give me that.
I mean, I'd be like... watching. Don't get me wrong.
Right? But who wouldn't? Nobody's going to be like, oh, damn, it's this rivalry again. I'm stoked about it. Like, I would watch the Manawa play the Blues like four times in a season and be stoked about it. But if you want to put other injections in, there's opportunities there. I know Moana Pacifica has been lobbying to get a women's team up and running. That would be hugely attractive to a number of women in our game, because even more so in women's rugby is our game built upon Pacifica talent, like here in Aotearoa. Right. Like, there are so many. Like, don't tell me you couldn't establish another team. Well, we've seen versions of it with the Penina Pacifica that played in the Super W. So, you know, do that. That's one extra team. Highlanders have always had enough. We've always had enough to field an extra team too. You look at these rosters around the competition, there's so much talent that didn't get any game time as well because the season was so short. You know, I heard Ruahe Demont's comments on this after the final where she said, you know, part of the reason why a crossover with Super W, you know, people go, oh, they're not up to our standard, la la. But she said, yeah, but then that would give us the opportunity to give some of our wider squad a run. So, like, it maybe we wouldn't be playing our strongest team against that. And there's probably, I think, a layer of arrogance there from New Zealand rugby players where I'm like, you know what? I don't think Australia is as far off as we think they are.
Mm.
But I think that, you know, if you were playing a team that you didn't think was going to be as strong, that is where you get to get your wider roster a chance to play. And then that's more people getting to play more quality rugby. So, like, there's definitely the player base. We know it there is because NRLW is signing all of them. Right. So if you're telling me there's not enough Opiki players, go look at the NRL rosters because there are so many New Zealand women's rugby players, union players, that are on NRL rosters.
It's one of those constant mysteries of trying to watch rugby in the United States. Like, I can watch the FPC and I can watch Super Rugby Opiki. So the Super W, I listen to podcasts every week talking about it. I can't see it. I have no idea what's happening with it. It's very strange.
Come on. Come on, Rugby Australia. Release the tapes.
Seriously. Like,
Stan
I mean, you've got the sevens out there. That I love. But so I've got two words for you. Kalia Awa. How good was she in this final? How impressive has been her debut season? And is she an instant black fern for you?
She will be like one of the bolters, right? Like, I would say this is also part of the longest story because she is the Hawke's Bay Tui halfback, right? Mm. So her pairing with Kristen Cottrell, who was the number 10 for the Blues, they play their provincial rugby together at the Hawke's Bay, which is why you saw Hazel Tubik and Arikiana Marino Tohenu named as that starting combination in Chiefs Manawa because they play all of their provincial rugby together for Counties Manukau. So you actually had two provincial pairings running against each other there. Now, the Kalia, I'm still bitter at the Poa for letting her out of our region because the Hawke's Bay is a feeder for our region. So where the heck was the phone call?
Damn it!
Get me on them. I'll recruit them anyway.
You know, somebody along the line made a bad decision. Somebody was like, she's too young. She's too blah, blah, blah.
Or like, oh, we'll talk to her. But like, they'd already got a phone call. Yeah, so Carly like had a fantastic season for the Hawke's Bay. This is the Hawke's Bay who had just been promoted last season from the within Whareparama Cup. There's two divisions. There's the championship,
right,
and then there's the championship. They have to, you have to win your way
it's
into
like
the top
NPC
grade
from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it is really tough, I will say, to not just get kicked out the next season. It's so hard. So the fact that the Tui did so well in that first season up in the Premiership, actually knocked over Auckland, who ended up winning the thing. I mean, that's outrageous. So Kalia was a key component of that. She carried that form from the provincial rugby into the Super Rugby. But yeah, the game change that she came and shifted. I mean, Mel Puckett's been having a good season for the Blues, but she was just that injection that was needed in terms of that pivot. So it is an interesting question right now. Two of the hottest positions, I think, in terms of competition within Black Fern squads, number eight, number nine. So who's going to be our number eight? Who's going to be our halfback? I think, unfortunately for Arihiana, I think we played Kendra Kotsedge too long. If I had been honest with her around when she was hitting her peak, you would have started to phase her out from about 2018 in terms of where she was really at in terms of her pace and her game management. I think, unfortunately for Arihiana, her story is one of many international players where you actually spent your best playing years in the shadow of someone else. And so I think, unfortunately for her, she's kind of at the end of her international career.
I see.
And Eritana Hohaia is the number one halfback in New Zealand right now. The game that Manawa and Poa played against each other, the pivotal moment that Eritana gifted to the Poa to actually make that game a potential win was when she snaked Arihiana at the back of the scrum. She timed that perfectly and came through to make her knock it on, and Arihiana does not do that. So this is, you know... So for my mind currently, if we're picking on pure form, your starting nine is Eritana, then your bench is Arihiana, and then you're rounding out that squad probably with Arihiana Baylor, not Arihiana. They're close, but not the same.
Right.
And then Kalia, you would have to say, would be the fourth player in the mix that's being brought into those camps.
Well, it's incredible to think about, like, the Women's World Cup in New Zealand feels like it just happened. But next year, the Women's World Cup kicks off in England. Can you give us a few players that, you know, are on your radar, people who you're looking at like, oh, this is her time to shine. This is somebody who are going to be some household names by the end of that tournament.
For sure. I mean, it is shorter because of the COVID delay. We have only got 3 years between tournaments. So you're not...
By the way, as a fan, is great because it's only a three-year wait instead of four. I'm like, yes, it's back!
Yeah. But I mean, I feel like we're all like, oh, it feels so short. It's like, because it is short. Like,
And they didn't change the branding or anything. I remember the whole thing and I'm like, you know what? Oh, that's good. I'm fine. That's great.
I have to say, the Rugby World Cup 2021 played in 2022 quickly all the time was a mouthful, but anyway, players to watch. I think, like I say, I think the most interesting battle right now is at our nine. So I feel currently, based on trajectory, that it will be Eritana Hohaia who will end up being our starting nine come Rugby World Cup. The next question is around number eight. So, and actually that then spills over into loose
balls. I really want to hear your answer. This is a great one.
So obviously Liana Mikieli Tu'u had been like red hot, and she's a fantastic eight in a way that's maybe less like razzle dazzle, but just like the work rate is unreal. I mean, there was that clip from last year's Pack 4 where she made like seven tackles in 45 seconds against Canada, which is just like unmatched. Okay. But then Leila Sa'i, and I think I'm saying that last name right, Arohamai, if that's not correct, but she was phenomenal for the Hurricanes Poa. There were a couple of games there in Opiki where it was Leila versus everyone. Like, she was just making mad meters up through the middle. It was unreal, right? But then the other eight that's out there is Kaipor Olsen Baker. Now, Kaipor was set to rip up the World Cup in 2022, but she broke her leg in the Whareparama Cup.
I don't know
Cup.
That name. Wow.
Yeah, just out from obviously the beginning of the tournament. So she didn't have the time to heal the break and get back on the field. So she was due to hit her straps then. It has taken a while to come back into form. She made a really savvy move, which was moving down to Mata 2 this season. Best thing she could have done, because the thing that Mata 2 is known for is that conditioning and that fitness, and that's what she needed.
Oh.
She needed someone to ride her to get her into that form, and boy howdy, like she was right up there throughout the season in terms of, top. She's in the top five for number of carries, for line breaks, for all of this type of thing. Very strong ball carrier, phenomenal. So I would be very surprised if we don't see her in the mix. So I'm thinking it will be interesting at Pat 4. If I was Alan Bunting, I'd be looking at probably my starting back row being some combination of Kennedy Simon, Liana Makiele-Tu'u, and Leila Saie together, and then Kai
Okay.
Poor Olsen Baker on your bench. Now that then starts being really interesting in terms of who makes room for that, and then what flow on does that have into your tight five. So I think Alana Bremner is going to have a hard time getting game time with the form that those women are in. I think Maya Roos will see her, she's played a combination of six and lock this Opiki season, but I think she'll have to go back into those locks in order to get that game time. And then in terms of other quality flankers, I mean, I'm not sure if we're going to see Lucy Jenkins. I don't know if we'll see Kendra Reynolds. These are quality people, but it's just going to be so hard to get past that form.
I mean, it almost makes me sad. The question of who starred in the 2021 play to 2022 World Cup. Are we not going to see? Is Stacey Walker going to be there? I love her. Wonder Woodman. Who are we going to lose? These stars that became household names just a couple of years ago.
I mean, therein also lies like an interesting question about when is the point where sevens players in New Zealand are used as the bandage for the lack of investment in the 15s? Because
Right.
that's been the truth since 2017, since the Olympics became part of the factor, and that sevens players are then paid for out of high performance sports New Zealand rather than out of rugby budgets. They were the
Oh.
first professional part of women's rugby in New Zealand, which is why you've seen, Stacey and Portia and Sarah Hiddeney all be able to come across, and Ruby Tui all be able to come across and do well, because they've been pros for 10 years. They've had the best investment of them as players. Now, the
Right.
difference coming into this World Cup is that there is that better investment in 15s players. 15s
Oh.
players now have been fully professionalized. By the time we hit the World Cup, have been fully professionalized for 2 years. They will have also had more domestic competition to play in, or international tests to play. So now becomes the question of, are they good enough? And that's a
Right.
very
I was just
interesting
going to say,
thing.
is that actually a good thing? Because, oh
Yeah,
man.
because Portia Woodman, unreal. But let's be honest about
The way
Portia
she
when
can
we
just
hit
shove you
2025.
aside, she's like, you know what? You two, you thought you were going to tackle me? No, not today.
Yeah. So no, like so Portia Woodman is this like in like talismanic player for us, and probably I would say in the Jonah Lomu-Vaid, probably the first name that became crossover, like people
Right.
knew, regardless of how much they knew about women's rugby. Portia Woodman was a name people knew. But I would say to you, like, the form that Caitlin Vahakolo is currently in is unreal. Like, she is, it's going to be so interesting. Like, Aisha Letianga, who came on for Portia when Portia got knocked out in the World Cup final, and who was brilliant, is coming back from an ACL right now. And I'm like, wow, that is a competitive place as well. Because the form that Caitlin Vahakolo was in, Martha Mataele was in during Opiki, Ruby Tui as well. But like, who gets that start out of those three? So now you're bringing Portia in. All tricky. And also Portia, who is probably at the tail end now of her career too. She wants to have more babies. I know she does. She wants to retire and be a builder with Renee. Like, she's ready for that. I wonder, it'll
Those
be
babies
interesting
better not
after the
mouth off.
Olympics.
That's all I know.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting after the Olympics, I guess, to see where these women move, because like a number of them will be kind of, looking at other things. They've been at the top of the world there for a long time. Are they going to want to keep being in that space? Stacey, though, please come back. I know that Ruahei technically got the player of the game in that final, but piss off. It was Stacey Waka. Tell me it
Yeah.
wasn't Stacey Waka. She was unreal in that game.
I'm so lucky because her brother Bodine Waka He's been one of the greatest Free Jacks players we've ever had here. So she came to see him a couple of times. I got to see Stacy walking around my little local stadium. I got pictures with her. Just like, oh, hey. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, she's such a sweetie. But like, and actually, Teresa Fitzpatrick, another player that didn't get talked about much during the Rugby World Cup, but like, Teresa, her work at second five really lit a lot of Stacey up, right? Like she made her look really good. But then having said all of that, Sylvia Brunt is another player that is coming through and is coming through really, really hot. She's
right,
like 5 years old. No, she's not. I think she's maybe, 20 now. Maybe. Like she's that so young. Five. Yeah, she, yeah. So it's like, but she is like, unreal and is only going to get better and is such a wee sweetie. I adore Sylvia. So like she's going to be coming through. It's just, there's so like, it's going to be, what is exciting for me is that there's going to be a real competition between 15 players and sevens players, that it's not just assumed that sevens gets to choose anymore, and that there really is a competition because we have actually invested that little bit more in our top level. I still want us to do more below it. But when it comes to those currently in the Black Ferns program, they are getting a better standard than they ever have before.
Well, the Red Roses are a threshing machine right now. But that's what we thought coming into the World Cup final last time. Can New Zealand repeat? Are you gonna go back to back?
I mean, we always can. Like, this is the this is the thing. Like, we always can. There's no there's no writing off. And like, there's some really interesting, I like the mind games of it all. There's some really interesting stuff that happens there too, where I think, oh man, how long have we got? Like, there's a whole thing that you could do in terms of intersection of class and things within sports and how that impacts resilience and then how that impacts like mental performance within games. I think that there's a really big thing you can unpack there. Yeah, because like the reality is for a number of our players, like rugby is the escape and the joy in their life, by no means the hardest part. Whereas I don't know if that's entirely true for all of the women that are currently playing top flight in English rugby. It's to do with like where people's on ramps are though, like still, and it's changing over time, but like most recently within England setups, most women have come into that game pretty late and they've come in via university. Well, and same with US, right? And with that comes a different class element. Like you aren't going to be bringing people from all aspects of your society if you are having, you know, university as the barrier to getting into a sport, you know, whereas like for example here for a long time it's been high school, but there is this wave of kids that are coming through. I mean, I coach my local club team. There's kids that I'm coaching now and like they've been playing since they were 6-7 years old. Like they are so sharp now, like the rugby IQ is just so much higher. We're seeing that change obviously within England and things too, but I don't know if it's hit yet in terms of those squads. And I think that that stuff matters when it comes to tournaments, because tournaments are head games as much as they're talent games, you know? And the longer that clock goes down and like it's within reach, anything can happen out there. And we saw
what's your take on the you know, the differences in as far as coaching from the last World Cup to this upcoming one? Is that a concern for you? A lot of people love to give a lot of credit to the coaching for New Zealand last time.
And that's,
and said, that's, oh, well, it's him.
Misguided as well. Yeah, right. No, that's misguided as well, right? Because show me another group of players that could be given a whole new game plan and be able to absorb and apply within 6 months. I don't care how good of a coach you are. That is to do with the talent that you're working with, right?
Yep.
And I think it's also doing, it speaks to like the untapped potential of that talent that was sitting there waiting to be unleashed. And we knew that based on like what we've seen. So it's, you know, put a competent coach in there and then suddenly they look amazing. So I think Bunce is a good, he knows how to coach women. He is the best, right? Like if you want to talk about to a man that understands how to be coaching women, he is your best example, because he'll tell you it's about coaching rugby players. Like all this like bullshit that we see that it's so different, it's not really. Like the differences are Like I was just mentioning, the on-ramps, when people are coming into rugby, the infrastructure, what challenges there are around navigating that, the pathways, they are significantly shorter in terms of between club and international. And so that then means that people are having to learn in a high-pressure, big stage that they don't have to in men's rugby. They get tested a lot more along the way, so that there is more personnel management that is required from that. Because you're asking people to do more before they're ready, because we're not letting them get ready in other spaces. So, like all of that stuff, right? So, he's a good coach. I'm very interested about Mitchell. I'm not sure about him yet. I'm going to be honest. Like he's a not a beloved coach out of New Zealand. Like there is a lot of stories about his kind of quite harsh operating style. I don't know if that's what's needed for England. Like, to be honest with you,
Seems like,
I feel like they already had that, you know. What's his face? Middleton was so officious, right? Like, and he was so rigid into the point of constricting again the potential which was in that side, which we are, to be fair to Mitchell, starting to see a bit more of, right? But like, he was so, it was like, as soon as you hit X, then Y happens. And to be honest with you, that's what I hated when I played in England. It was like, I had arguments with coaches about that. I was like, you've given me a launch play that's like seven phases long. If the space is in front of me after the second, I'm gonna just go. And it was like, no, you've got to do this. And I was like, but that's stupid though, because like the launch play is to make space. So once there's space, we go, right? Like that type of stuff. So I feel like that constriction jacket has been taken off that team in a way, but has the way of like really with England, it's like they're up until they're down, and then they get right in the hole. I just feel like their head game is what needs. And I think like you look at, say, for example, Scotland, that's been the secret. Like I remember talking to Rachel Malcolm about this ages ago. You know, she was saying that they needed the mental skills coach. Well, they've got one now, and look at how they're doing. It was less about like X number of, you know, hitting X on your Bronco or whatever on this. It's about that whole piece and around that head game, because winning and losing are habits. And if you're doing something that's going out of that habit, like England had not even prepared for the eventuality that they might end up being on a back foot. So when they met that reality, they don't know how to handle it.
Don't you think that
That's my
World Cup
read.
final came down to a mental game? Like that last that line out, it's so iconic in like the history of World Cups. Like it was such a big
I think it
play.
did. And like also, let's be honest, Druan missing the kick to give us a final was a mental. She can kick that kick 1,000 times out of 10.
I know. I
What
still feel bad
stopped her
for
from
her.
getting that? Yeah. I was not okay when that kick happened.
Yeah.
I was behind the post. She kicked it at me.
I
She must have
felt
seen how sad I was and helped me.
that.
But you know, like she didn't miss that because she didn't have the skills to deliver that. She missed that because the pressure of the moment was too intense, right? Like that was her processes around how to manage that pressure weren't quite right in terms of getting her to be able to nail that. When it comes to that line out, like I've spoken to Jonah about it. Like, so Jonah and I played, we debuted for Wellington at the same time, right? So, and I was a hooker and she's my jumper. So I threw to her a lot, and I have also tried to throw past her a lot at club. And like, that
Just
is,
cuz.
yeah, that is classic Jonah. Like that's her up and down. She loves a cheeky snake there, but she like, they threw the same line out twice. If you go back and you watch it, they had just thrown that previously and she had disrupted. And then they threw the same thing again. And it was like, what was that? And that is England, that they were playing like, when I'm X, I do Y. Look up. I still don't understand why they didn't kick it. Do you know what I mean? Like, why didn't they kick for the three? It didn't make any sense to me. I think if they'd done that, they would have won. Like
They probably should have won that game.
They should have, but ultimately, in those moments, like it comes down to what's going on in the story up here. And like, I remember at halftime, I saw my friend. They were very sad, and they were like, "What's going to happen?" And I said, "Hey, we were down by the same 7 points in 2017, and we won this game." Now that's something that our Black Ferns team knows. They like these women know how to play a final. Like they will
And
not write
to be
themselves
fair,
out
all
of
the pressure was
anything.
on the Red Roses. Like the entire world said the Red Roses are destined to win. They're going to beat everybody, no problem. And then it became a problem late in the tournament, and then it was up for grabs. New Zealand was like, you know
Yeah, I mean,
what?
I would only challenge you that in terms of like New Zealand public. Okay, so like
Okay.
my challenge for the first part of that tournament was having to temper expectations because
Oh.
New Zealand public, the general like knowledge of women's rugby was a pretty shallow pool, and all they
Sure.
really knew is, oh, our team wins everything, right? Which is true. Like we have won the World Cup more than anyone else, and we were actually a defending title, but that was like the absorption that they had absorbed leading into that World Cup. So they were like, oh, World Cup, we win World Cups. That was what they knew of it. So the first
Interesting.
like pool play, I was having to be like, no, okay, so the thing is the Red Roses are so hot right now and have invested and developed and done all of the right things, and so they are setting themselves up for success in a way that we really haven't. So having to do that education piece through that whole first bit. But then like when you come into that last week, like again, all the pressure was on them to make the final. There was a little bit of pressure off there, right? Because they'd already overperformed. But really, general New Zealand expected them to win. Like
Interesting.
general punter, at no point, if you ask man on the street during that tournament, at no point did they say think anyone was going to win except New Zealand.
Wow.
You know?
As somebody who lives in a rugby desert in the United States,
Yeah.
I'm desperately culling, as much coverage and consuming as much media as I can, and it was universal. The Red Roses all the way. England are going to
Oh yeah.
roll, and they're going to win by a lot.
Yes. I think everybody who is like again engaged in it, definitely. The thing was, you know, like we were talking about, that the 70% of those in attendance at the final had not been to rugby games before. So they're reading like skim. It's a skim, right? So they're like, oh yeah, okay, so the England have been winning quite a lot, but New Zealand won last time, so they'll win. Do you know what I mean? Like it was really, for a long time, it's been like something that's been brought up every now and then as a soothing a balm when, like, say, the All Blacks aren't in a good run. They're like, oh, we're still the best at women's rugby, right? Like, that's actually how much it's spoken about. Like, you have to remember that. So, even during the peak, right, like of us hosting that World Cup, in terms of media coverage, we only got to a peak of 28% of media coverage talking about women's sports. That's women's
Really?
sports as a whole. Like
Wow.
you have to break down within that to then get the subsection of that 28% that was talking then about women's rugby. So like there is still a massive knowledge gap between like women's and men's. And so like, yeah, like I said, a lot of my time spent during that tournament was like trying to bring expectations into alignment with reality. And look, there's still part of me that thinks, as magic and as special as that was to me personally, to have like that validation moment of being like, everybody here loves this as much as I do. And that I'm also here with a number of women that have played. Like it was a reunion in terms of so many women that I've known across our community who got to also witness and share. And I think, you know, in terms of biggest missed opportunities, boy, we just did not embrace that whole story and all of those amazing women into that moment. But like that was all really beautiful and important. If I'm being realistic though, do I wish that the Black Ferns had won that game? No. Because I think it let New Zealand rugby off. It let them do what they always do, which is, oh, we don't need to invest though, because we win anyway. Like they really, I think had we lost,
This is
there
such an
would have been a
interesting take
better
because I wondered
stop.
this about Canada, where Canada are like, well, we're the last, entirely non-professional, so-called non-professional team, and yet here we are, and we're performing at this level. I was worried that gave them license to be like, well, why should we start funding you now? Like, look where you are without us doing anything.
I see that, and I hurt for Canada in the same way. Like they're just, I would no disrespect to the USA, but I think like Canada is just in terms of like current one through 23 talent that they have right now, were they to make those players professional, like honestly, they are in a
Unbelievable.
World Cup final. Like they are, they and they have, and you know, even speaking to lovely Stephanie White, you know, Sophie de Goody's mum, during the who's a legend in her own right, first captain of Canada, but like speaking to her about the frustration that she felt when she landed in New Zealand, you know, I'm telling you about that gap of knowledge, but like how nobody had written up Canada anywhere as a, you know, semi-finalist, let alone like contender. And let's remember, they were so close to knocking over you, knocking over England in
So
that semi-final.
close. So
Like,
close.
there
It
were
very much
a
could have happened.
couple of moments where that could have been them, and
They were so good.
playing them at their own game too, because everyone talked about England's maul, but actually Canada's maul. I mean, that's how Emily Totosi had was the top try scorer for a minute there, was off the back of their maul, right? Like, so all of that stuff. So I'm just like, I totally see it, and so that's why I'm like, for so long, when it, when you look at like our rugby infrastructure here in Aotearoa, a talent has bridged the gap in terms of the lack of investment, resources, programming, opportunity. Our talent has covered for all of those inadequacies. And so there was a frustration that like our talent did it again, you know, where it was like, oh, I kind of wish we hadn't, because the best performing union in terms of doing what we want you to do, building something bespoke that works for your women, putting in the investment, doing it in a sustainable way, building this thing over time so that you're now regularly like putting big crowds in attendance at these games, doing all of the right stuff. It would have been better for the women's game as a whole if they'd got to take that trophy home.
Wow. So just to be clear, it would have been better for New Zealand rugby if they had lost that World Cup final.
I believe so. Because I
Wow.
think then they would have had to invest in the team. Instead, they got to say, oh, what we're doing right now is good
Yeah,
enough.
they
It
got to say,
wasn't.
hey, we've done it. We've got it
Yeah.
just right. Wow.
So they got to like continue to not learn the lessons of 2014. We still haven't learned that lesson. Like the answer, like the problems were there in 2014, and we've just carried it through. We still haven't addressed that fundamental issue.
The mystery of the women's game is one of the reasons I'm so interested in it. Like there's all these dichotomies and weird self-contradictions involved with it. It's a fascinating history. But Alice, I asked you to join me for an hour here, and it's way past that now. I already, when just before we started, I hinted. I was like, you know what? I'm prepared to sit here and ask you all these questions, but the fact is, you probably have things to say that I'm not equipped to even ask you about. Like, I'm just this random white guy sitting in America thinking about rugby and just asking questions. There's got to be something that I am unequipped to ask you about or would never think of to ask you about. What's on your mind about women's rugby right now? What do you want to tell my listeners and the world? Because my goal here is to grow the game. What can we learn from you about the women's game? What's coming forward?
I mean, I think the answer to that is like, I guess I get really frustrated with the softly, softly, and the slowly, slowly stuff. And also, like, the way in which the justification of that slow moving and little money is all like based on a set of assumptions that just are not there for men. Like, men's rugby does not make money. We know that. That's, you know,
It's true.
the Eagles went bankrupt. New Zealand rugby was in the in debt before COVID. English Premiership is falling to pieces. The World Rugby themselves not in the flashiest of shapes. Men's rugby doesn't make money, but does anybody stop in terms of what they need to do in terms of investing and trying to like invest their way out of it? Like when there's a problem with rugby, men's rugby, they don't cut it. They invest their way through, and we don't do that. As soon as we are hit with something, we go, oh, that's just proof. Proof of what? Proof of like the benevolent paternalism that exists. Like, still, the biggest issue for like women's rugby is the sexist attitudes of those that run it. And until we like really own that and like dig that out at its root, we're going to have problems. And a real issue we have right now is there aren't enough people saying that. There are more and more people that are talking about rugby and are interested in it, which is beautiful. But too many of them are more concerned about preserving their paycheck than saying what needs to be said. And that is a frustration for me because it's like, what are we doing this for? What is this for? I don't want to recruit people into love or support or play a game that's hurting people. In a lot of ways, it is still. We're doing it in terms of how these players are being treated. We see it all the time when people are having to do, GoFundMes or whatever for injuries, and we're seeing,
Or for
number of
boot sometimes.
boots and just all the stuff we know isn't right, and yet we're still doing it. And we knew it wasn't right in 1995 when we made the men's game professional, but we're still doing it this way 30 years later for the women. It just doesn't make any sense to me. We copy and paste the broken parts of men's rugby, but none of the investment parts. And so sort that out, please.
Is do you you know can you play the optimist and say, but that's going to change? You as a person, do you feel like, okay, we're on the cusp of something new, or you just or do you just foresee same old, same old?
It's hard, right? Because I think often things like need to be entirely broken in order to then be fixed. But I
Right.
think that, so I think, when I'm saying like New Zealand would have been better to lose, I mean, I think we will lose in 2025 because right now, like the lessons learned after that, right, was like, oh, okay, cool, we can kind of do more of the same. We'll invest in a few people, but not in the whole thing. And so I think we're setting ourselves up on a trajectory there. Can we learn that lesson before we get there? That'd be nice. Will we? I don't think so. Will we learn it after? I also don't know. I just think, like, I think there's so many parts that are so loudly broken in men's rugby that I just don't think that people are able to see that a lot of the solutions are within our game. And I wish, like, if I was being an optimist, I'm like, please, like, let's use this as the opportunity to trial new and different. We have managed to do that once, right? And since the Rugby World Cup, which was WXV. WXV being the alignment of a global calendar that the men's game has been desperate for the last forever. And we brought it in. And now we showed what it could do, and now a version is being introduced for the men. It's from what, 2027 or something? So it's like,
Yeah,
do more of
I think so.
that. Yeah, do more of that. Understand that ours is an emerging market. It is a different market. The people that are attracted to the sport are fundamentally different too. And so understand that nuance, but then use that as an opportunity to try things and to do things differently, and then to build yourself to a different position. And I think, like, the obviously I wouldn't keep saying all this stuff if I didn't think there were people to hear it. And I think the positive, right, is that that is growing, that there are now, there is a general awareness, like just the fact that I have a job where I can do this full time, that wasn't for a long time the reality. The last time New Zealand rugby did some silly cuts and things, I made just as much noise, but less people heard it. So like that type of thing has changed. There is this next wave of talent that's coming through that is more than capable to like just play the best quality of rugby we've ever seen. I like I say, I see it right now. I'm going to club training in a couple of hours. The two MVPs we've had in game one and two of this season are both 16 years old. That's in a women's grade because they're just playing at a higher level of rugby intelligence, of rugby baseline skills than we've got in the rest of the squad. So it's like this next wave of talent is better than they've ever been, but also they are expecting better and they will not accept any less than better. And I think that's also where
I love
things
that.
change. Because it's not necessarily going to be rugby that figures it out, because it very, very rarely is it like systems of oppression that change themselves. It's external pressure that
Right.
changes that. It's this talent that now has options. Rugby can't keep sleeping. What forced New Zealand rugby to sort themselves out in 95, 96? It was rugby league. It's going to do the same thing here again. for women's rugby because it's back to the future. We've got exactly the same pressures going on
Wow.
here. So it'll be the external pressure from other codes. It's the obvious financial benefit that there is for attracting a whole new audience. It's all of these pieces that can come together. But I think, people call them entitled. Good. We've made them believe that they actually belong. And so that's something that we need to take like more heart in and be proud of, that people feel like they're entitled to be here and entitled to have their talent recognized, supported, and developed. Like that's got to be a good thing.
The worldview seems to be women's rugby is on the upswing in a major way. They say it's the fastest growing sport in popularity. I guess I'm desperately trying to end on like a big old positive. Is that what you see? Do you see the sport growing and becoming better and better over the next 5 years? If you were in charge of everything, 5 years from now, are you like, yes, we've got this?
I think watching other countries is giving me hope. So, like I say, I think what England, how they're making moves, how they're building their ways into like sustainable sellouts of their games, like I'm seeing them move in a way that like the Matildas, the football team in Australia, moved after the their Football World Cup, like really building
I
that.
saw the
So I
welcome
think,
home celebrations for that. That looked pretty cool.
yeah, right. But like the reality is 2025 is going to be the most attended and viewed World Cup there's ever been. They will sell out Twickenham. They will sell out Twickenham on the opening match, forget the final. Like we can just say that right now. I put me on record, it's going to happen. So that is going to be, that's because of the like multi-level work that England has done around that whole infrastructure to build to that moment. Looking across the ditch at Australia, though, they have made some really interesting moves and even just like the last 18 months, finally giving those women like a more decent paycheck, giving them a amazing coach. Like Joe Yap is one of the best coaches in the game right now. They cut England's lunch by taking her. She was supposed to coach England and they took
That's
her.
right.
So she's there now. They have got play, they have always had the talent there. We know that. Like just look at rugby league, right? Like they've had, and look at sevens. So they've had the talent there, but they haven't had the investment or the like tutelage to really like bring them out. So I would say it would not surprise me if they beat New Zealand within the next 5 years. They never have. I think they'll do it within the next five. They might do it
Never
by the
have, is
next
that
World Cup.
right?
Never. Not since international rugby has begun, and we play them the most, and they've never done it, but I think they can now. So like that gives me heart, the way that they are also supporting the Pacific. I think, like I say, when I look down the tiers, when I look at what the potential is that is sitting there in our Samoan women's rugby, in our Tongan rugby, in our Fijian rugby, and then in other nations too that we haven't seen yet, like the Cook Islands, like they
Yeah,
are
it's so funny.
beating,
That
no,
just
like
came
in.
into
Yeah, like in rugby league, the Cook Islands have beaten England. Don't tell me that they couldn't end up, tipping people over when it comes to rugby union. And also, do you know that a number of
Wow.
fantastic rugby union players, Maya Ruse, Ruhei Dumont, Cook Islanders. So they are, they've
Oh.
got that, like there are a number of players that they could end up getting on the second wave. So I think like that type of stuff, the transfer windows that have expanded out, I'd love to see that. The stand down reduced more. Honestly, I think if you, I would love us to be more like rugby league on that. I don't understand why we're locking people up. Like, if you're not being picked by New Zealand, you should get to go and play for Samoa. Why not?
Yeah.
We get to see the best players right now. Why not?
Alice Soper, rugby genius. I can't tell you how much this has been fantastic. I'm looking at the screen right now, and it's a beautiful day in the Aotearoa where you are. I'm sitting here in my dank, dark basement late at night, but I just can't. If I tried to tell you how grateful I am for the time you spent today, I would fail. So I'm not going to try too hard. Thank you so much for your time. Anything you need to plug or tell us about, what's coming up for you? Are you got any articles?
I mean, I think probably the most unfiltered version of me and my thoughts are on my Substack that I have, which is Alice's Soapbox.substack.com or whatever that is. So I usually write something once a week, and that's I don't people do pay me for that, but then I don't tend to put things behind a paywall. So it's, you know, I am very fortunate that people just choose to support that because they can. And that then subsidizes it for everybody else. So regular popping off there. I also now am lucky enough to have a monthly column for Scrum Queens, which is a
big fan.
Yeah, I mean, but of course, like if you are a fan of women's rugby, I mean, I'm deeply honored to have been given that platform because for a long time they were the only place that I knew that would talk about the things I cared about.
Me too.
So, so I'm currently working on my piece for them this month where actually I'm, oh God, I'm opening another whole can of worms. Sorry, David. But where I'm talking to a number of rugby mums. Because I've been concerned about this trend that we're seeing of us focusing on super speedy returns and the inadvertent pressure that that's building on other mums to return to play. So I've got a cross-section of current players who are across the tiers of rugby where I'm having that conversation with them about their experiences so that we can just try and have at least one balancing out, you know? I think these women are amazing when they manage to do it. But I think also we need to remember that the reason why these stories are amazing is because they are exceptional. They are not the rule. And for most people, you know, it's a trauma on the body, no matter how smooth that birth goes. So we need to be realistic around not putting undue pressure on ourselves to achieve the impossible. So that's something I'm working on writing at the moment. So if you want to read that, that'll be out sometime this month when I finish writing it.
I love it.
On Scum Queens.
Thank you so much for joining me here tonight. It's just been, revelatory. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. It's been fantastic. I hope maybe we'll catch up again, maybe in the near future.
Don't you worry. Just monologue everybody to death. No, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers. Talk to you soon. And be well.
Cheers, mate. Thank you, too.
It gives me great pleasure to be here today.
Sports Social Podcast Network.